Sky Full of Bacon by Michael Gebert presents an audio bonus podcast with Herb and Kathy Eckhouse. This is kind of like the extras on Disc 2 of a DVD. Disc 1 would be Prosciutto di Iowa, the 10th Sky Full of Bacon video podcast, which is about the prosciutto maker La Quercia in Norwalk, Iowa. If you've watched that, you know that Herb and Kathy Eckhouse make amazingly good Italian-style prosciutto in Iowa from American free-range and organic pork. If you haven't watched it, go watch it! In a 90-minute interview, the Eckhouses were very thoughtful and insightful on such issues as the humane treatment of animals, the local eating movement, and starting an artisanal food business. But only a small part of our conversation could fit into the video. So I've assembled the highlights into an audio podcast that takes you deeper into these subjects. For more links and information, visit skyfullofbacon.com/blog. And thanks to Kevin McLeod for the sonatina that's playing behind me.
You know, we lived in Parma for 3.5 years, and, you know, prosciutto is a main staple of the diet. So, and we really enjoyed it. And then we came back, and one of the things about Iowa that just, you know, strikes you when you come back is how rich and fecund and fertile it is.
We started off importing prosciutto di Parma because one of the things we thought was that that would give us a way into restaurants and delicatessens and stores, and we would learn a lot about the business doing that. And while we were selling the prosciutto di Parma, we would be working on creating our own business here. And so and that business we did out of our house. We rented cold storage space for the prosciutto, but we did all the packaging and shipping out of our house.
Out of our garage.
And then people would say, well, you can't make prosciutto in the United States because the pigs are different. They're a different age at slaughter. They're different breeds. You don't have the air. So we thought, well, before we get a whole lot further along in this process, we need to try to make prosciutto here with American pork. And that was one thing you didn't mention, that we were really determined that we wanted to use non-confinement pork without any subtherapeutic antibiotics, that we really wanted to make something that was a good product from the life of the pig forward, instead of just tasting good at the very end.
Now, subtherapeutic, that's where they just give it to them
every day.
It's a low dose in their diet, and they grow faster. But they also excrete antibiotics. It gets into the water systems and into people.
It creates a breeding ground for antibiotic-resistant bacteria. Something like 80% of the antibiotics consumed in the United States are consumed by animals.
We decided to make prosciutto, and we had that. That was
Batch was good.
Our first batch was good.
Mm-hmm. 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 And we hung it in the basement. We dry cured it in our basement. We did the refrigeration, the cold part of the process we did in our refrigerator in the garage, and then when it was ready to be moved into the warmer area, we hung it in our guest bedroom in the basement.
And right from the first batch, we tried to do something. Well, we started working with cutting the meat differently from the whole leg prosciutto that they make in Italy, and they make really everywhere, by opening the leg up, you know, so that it would dry more evenly, so that we could use less salt, so that we had also been exposed to that. I've been exposed to that in Italy. Producers in Italy do everything. You know, when it comes to curing meat, there's very little new ground, you know. So I thought this would be a good idea based on what we learned by selling the whole leg prosciutto di Parma in, you know, basically in the Midwest. So
one thing
even from the start, we started doing that. which was a challenge, you know, because trimming meat is not something you're born knowing how to do.
Yeah.
You know, it does take practice.
And one thing we didn't want to have to do was press the prosciutto, because most of the prosciutto that people buy is in a banjo shape. It's had the bone, it's been cured with the bone in, and then they take the bone out, and then they press it with, is it 15,000 kilos of pressure to force the meat back into shape, and it creates a sort of banjo-shaped piece of meat.
It looks like the same shape as a leg. You know, if you look at those,
except that it's
bone-in legs. Yeah, except that it's flat.
Except that it's flattened, and it does change the texture of the meat. And we really noticed that because we brought in some bone-in prosciutto di Parma, and we also brought in what they call apera, which is a piece of prosciutto di Parma that has been boned but not pressed. And it was delicious. It had a great texture because it had never been pressed, but it was a real pain to use because it fell apart, because the meat had been, all the connections had been ripped apart taking the bone out. And so people loved the way it tasted. They loved the way it felt in the mouth, but they didn't ever want to use it because they couldn't get a single slice out of it.
We started with a really close relationship with Nyman Ranch, and we did a lot of work with them, the first meat that we aged was Nyman pork, and then the other group that we worked with real closely at the outset was Organic Valley, you know, and we found very early on that they really were looking for somebody like us, because typically for them, you know, their prime cuts are the loins and, you know, to some extent the bellies and the ribs, but they were, you know, the rear legs were somewhat difficult for them. You know, Nyman developed its own ham business, and until really Chipotle came along, a lot of those specialty pork companies were really having a hard time with what to do with the rear legs. We committed to this category of meat, so then once, you know, Nyman was one of the larger potential suppliers, so then we had to go look for the others, you know, and, you know, you start just networking around to find those people who were, because it's not a big world, you know, even today there are probably three or four producers of that kind of meat in the United States.
And another thing that I thought was interesting is that it's not enough to find a source of the meat. You also have to find a place that will slaughter the animals in an acceptable way across a lot of fronts. I mean, it has to be acceptable in the sort of oxymoronic humane slaughter way. But it also has to be that they have to be willing to not use hooks to move the legs down the line. They have to be willing to cut the ham, so that the hind leg, a certain way. Otherwise, we can't use it.
And there were a lot.
A big difference in the industry for them, because they're not accustomed to that. I mean, you get, they're used to making, you know, if it's hind leg, it's going to be chopped up, or it's going to be made into a ham that's going to be, you know, it's brined and pressed and cooked. And for us, any gash that they make 8 to 12 months later, it's the Grand Canyon and the piece of meat is ruined.
But they're even simple things, like we run what I call a bus system. Okay, so you've seen the racks out there. So the racks, each of those rooms is designed for a certain number of racks. And our cycle is based on the number of pieces that fit on that number of racks. Okay? So, like, if we're going to do 4 racks in a week, okay, we have X number of spots. Okay? So we're buying X number of hams. Okay? Well, that's, like, unheard of. People buy weight. They don't buy pieces, you know. So that was, you know, like a whole education process in and of itself.
Every week we go, don't these people know how to count?
Yeah, it was just, it was a change, you know. And
we were doing something different, and the pace of a slaughterhouse is really fast. What they've always done is the same stuff And there's no particular reason for them to think that they had to change, and they didn't understand how important it was at our end of it. I'd hear Herb on the phone all the time. We only have room for X number of hams.
And when 5% you give us, or 10% more, well, where are you going to put them?
Yeah.
You know, so it just doesn't fit. So, I mean, right now we're working through issues on our refrigeration system. And, you know, our refrigeration people have had an extremely difficult time kind of wrapping their heads around the idea that we don't use refrigeration just to control temperature. We use it to take out water, you know. So then it's a whole different set of performance criteria. So, I mean, pretty much all the way along, everything with the building was, you want to do what, you know? Is so like, what are the internal surfaces have to be? What's the environment inside the building like? You know, and there's one architectural firm in town. When we were looking for like somebody to design the building, and the guy said, "Oh, well, what you've really got in there is a marine environment." And I thought, you know, that's probably. I thought that I was almost tired of them, although, you know, they were known for their beautiful design and also for being extremely expensive, and I figured, you know, we aren't ready for that at this point.
We don't need to make an architectural statement. We're trying to make a prosciutto statement.
Yeah, a culinary statement.
Yes.
We're trying to make a culinary statement. So, anyway.
Yeah. But, you know, the people in Italy also, it was hard for them to wrap their heads around the idea that people didn't understand how, you know, the technical people for the building heating and cooling systems didn't understand. Well, how could that be? Because everybody knows.
And if you want Sunya,
business.
If you want Sunya, you just go out and buy Sunya.
Right.
And, you know, like if you were to go to anybody and say, "I want Sunya," they're going to go, "Huh?" You know,
right.
So it's, you know.
And things like the way the hams are cut. When Giorgio, who was our advisor, when he came and he saw what they had done to the first batch of raw legs that we brought in, he almost cried. I mean, it was just, he was almost undone by this. And all the way along, he would say, "Well, of course, you don't have to worry about this because, for example, the meat comes, it's certified trichina free, it's certified salmonella free." And we're going, "No, we have to prove that what we do takes care of those issues." And he'd say, "But that's impossible. That's ridiculous." And
yeah, it was a bridge. Mm-hmm. You know, we had a bridge between two worlds. You know, and it's still, you know, still that's certainly part of what we do, is try to bridge between those two worlds, and, you know, really focusing on creating something that's great to eat. You know, that's a whole different kind of thing for a lot of people. You know, mm-hmm. When I was at Pioneer, I started up a vegetable seed division for them. And one of the things that really got me was, you go to a sweet corn grower or a tomato grower or something, and he'd say, "Oh, I don't eat this stuff. I just ship it." You know, and, you know, that's really a foreign concept to me. You know?
Well, Herb is always saying to people, "Well, we don't like to call what we make product. It's food. It's prosciutto and guanciale and pancetta. It's not a product, because once you start thinking of what you're making as a product, it's all the same and it doesn't have any particular value."
Well, its value is just something to sell.
It's just something,
you know,
to sell.
And that doesn't, and right. That's, I don't think that's not what we're about. Yeah.
And it's really a challenge when people come here from another, to work for us from another meat company. It's all speed, 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 speed. And we tell them, "No, it's more important to do it right than it is to do it fast." You know?
Yeah, in fact, most of those, very few of those people make it here. You know, a lot of them don't.
They can't deal with it, because you have to keep telling them, "No, that's not right, that's not right," until they get it right. And some of them, they've been cutting meat for 20 years. They don't need us telling them how to cut meat. So.
Well, yeah, I mean, there you're talking about commodity meat. It's so cheap, you know, you hack a piece of it away, mm-hmm. You know, it's no big deal.
Right.
And here, I mean, I saw a lot of money going on the floor.
Yeah, sometimes I just walk away.
You just can't bear.
Well, you know, I don't, you know, like sometimes I just feel that, you know, my particular perspective as an owner and as the pocket is like not going to be constructive. You know, it's better off just, you know, going away and letting the scraps fall where they may. You know, because, you know, there's certain times that that kind of concern is not appropriate. You know, you got to, we've got to focus again on making something that's delicious. You know, that's the only way we can survive with the amount of handwork we do and the size that we have and the scale that we have, you know, and the amount that we pay for our meat. There's no other way for us to survive.
And the people who work for us, who stay with us, they really, I think, appreciate that and take a very active and personal interest in making something good and bring stuff to our attention.
Yeah, I think that's right.
You know, a better way to do it, or they're concerned that the way something's being put in a room is going to affect how it will age or lose moisture.
Yeah, they're definitely important.
They're really engaged.
Yeah.
And because we go out there also and work on the floor, they know that we really care, which is important.
But at the beginning, we were out there all the time.
All the time.
You know.
Yeah.
And it was. I told Mike that I couldn't afford to hire myself. I'm too slow.
Yeah. Well, the work, I've never done the deboning. I would not be able to debone. I've done everything else, even the wizard knife, but I've never done the deboning.
Yeah. It's better off somebody else to do it.
Now, when you started making prosciutto, I mean, you leaped into what seems to be the ultimate challenge of any kind of home charcuterie.
Right.
Did you try anything else first? Did you make any salami or anything? No.
No.
You just got a pig leg and started sticking salt on it?
Pretty much. I mean, that was our focus, you know. So, actually, we had gone to, I went to Iowa State Short Course, and there I met Paul Bertoli.
Okay.
And Paul was in the process of gathering information to start his company for Amani, you know, and Paul had written his book, Cooking by Hand, in which he includes a lot of recipes for various salumi, including prosciutto.
And he has drawings,
right.
A lot of detail.
Yeah, I actually brought it with me.
Did you? Yeah.
Freshen up on before.
And, you know, he said, oh, you got to make it. You know, you got to make it. And, you know, it was clear that we had to make it. I mean, you're not going to build something like this without knowing if you know. I mean, you know, it's great to have read all this stuff and be able to write all this stuff, but, you know, if you don't do it, you know, what do you really know? So.
And without the wind from the coniferous forest of the Apennines,
right, we didn't
we
know.
Needed to know. You know,
so it didn't know if the... the exhaust off I-80 would
would
trick.
Substitute.
Yeah.
Maybe that'll work. Yeah. So you know the proof is in the prosciutto. So we just jumped in. You know.
Mm-hmm.
Now one of the things about making prosciutto, I think that is you know not to let everybody in on our secret, but people have been making prosciutto for literally thousands of years. You know, and they didn't have refrigerators, and they didn't have buildings with computerized controls, and they didn't have, you know. And so, you know, I consider it a very robust process. It's something that stands a lot of abuse and, you know, buffeting. You know, if you don't do it exactly this way, it's not like it's going to kill you. Or, you know, right. If you, you know, you need
salami
to do it.
Salami is actually dangerous.
Right.
I mean, that's one of the things.
It's a robust process. You know, you can do it in different ways and it'll turn out. So,
It may be more good or less good, but it will be edible.
I felt like we could take a chance.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And plus, you know, at the end of the day, what are you out? If you buy a couple of pork legs and they don't work. you know.
But we would be out there with Paul's book open, looking at the drawings.
Yeah, we're trimming. You know, we try to use his guide, you know, his information for trimming. We did our salting a little differently, but we try to use his for trimming.
Well, tell me about, you know, there's the whole eating local thing, and it sounds like you have some local customers. How do you feel you fit into that kind of movement that's going on? Or
yeah, I think, again, I think one of the things that we discerned early on in terms of, like, whether this was a crazy idea or a crazy and stupid idea, you know, was that was something that was happening, you know, and that people were interested in foods that were made in the United States and foods that were made artisanally and foods that, you know, came from, weren't necessarily shipped over the ocean. But I've got to say that is a very positive thing for us, but I think, honestly, that the depth of the kind of if it's imported, it's better idea is strong. You know, it's not an idea that you just eliminate. You know, I've said to you before, we have to kind of win people over one bite at a time. I don't think it's not that broad a trend, at least in our category. You know, maybe in other categories, you know, certainly with, obviously, with greens or something, you know, but still, a lot of people will buy greens from far away. But it's not, we have, you know, like in Chicago, we'll have people like Karen Abadian and Paul Kahn and Paul Verant and, you know, Bruce Sherman and Sarah Stegner, and, you know, those people are totally into the idea and have been extremely supportive and kind to us. But, you know, when we get out into like a retail environment, it's greatly diluted.
And I, you know, one of the things about the local is you know some people, for them being a locavore means they won't go more than 100 miles from where they are. Well, that eliminates an awful lot from people's lives. Yeah. I mean, I think Google had a cafe and everything had to come from within 100 miles, which is not so bad if you're in San Jose. Because you can pretty much, there is kind of a lot within 100 miles, but they're never going to eat peanut butter.
Right.
Well, they wouldn't want to anyway.
Maybe not. Yeah. But, I mean, there are a lot of things that they couldn't eat. So, I'm always a little uncertain exactly what local means to people.
Well, and to me too, it's when you're talking about a, you know, a vegetable or fruit, it's, you know, there's very clear reasons why a Michigan peach that just came from up the road beats one that traveled from Chile.
Yeah, really.
But you're in the realm of things that were traditionally preserved precisely for travel. You know,
made to travel.
You know,
yes.
Like port or, yeah, you know, olive oil or, you know, so many of these things exist because it's the form in which it can travel.
Yes. Yeah.
And it can last a long time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So.
And it can last without a lot of energy input to make it last.
Right.
It doesn't have to be frozen. It doesn't have to be kept in a very difficult, finicky environment, which is,
you know, we try to support kind of our local food ecology. We work real hard to help, if we can, people who are making things locally that we think are really good, and, you know, introduce them to customers and distributors. And, you know, it's we'd like to see Iowa become known as a place where really great food is made, you know, rather than, you know, where there's just this endless sweep of corn and soybean fields and, you know, this beautiful topsoil that's, you know, sliding
going down
Mississippi, you know. And no, this is a place where we honor that beautiful patrimony by making something that's really good to eat.
Yeah.
I was talking, I happened to be at an event with Jean Joho.
Uh-huh.
And I mentioned, mm-hmm. you know, that I was coming to talk to you, and yeah. it was interesting. One of the first things he said was, "Oh, yeah, that guy's a really good marketer." And I thought it was interesting, you know, because people, I think a lot of people sort of see there's the authentic producers, and then there's the corporate marketers, and they're two very opposite ends of the spectrum. But I'm sure, you know, clearly marketing, you know, was a big part of getting people to buy this. So how do you sort of?
Well, that's really funny because, you know, I remember really vividly how we got connected with Jean Joho, you know, and it wasn't because we had a beautiful ad in a Slick magazine. You know, I called his restaurant and I never met the guy. I never talked to the guy, and I, you know, talked to the woman. I guess it was who was handling the reservations. And I said, you know, I'm making this prosciutto in Iowa, and I'd like to talk to Chef Joho. And, you know, about an hour later, he called back, you know, and that developed the relationship. And, you know, we, you know, just, we started servicing him directly that way. You know, it wasn't through some kind of, you know, intricately hatched strategy that, you know, multi-pronged, you know, yeah. multi-message, guerrilla marketing. No, I just called the guy and said, hey, you know, we're doing this. Would you like to try some, you know? And he was extremely positive about it. He liked eating it. And, you know, has always been really complimentary about what we make, you know, in terms of, you know, he thought it was delicious. And so it's interesting. Yeah, that's a funny thing.
I would say that our marketing strategy, if we have a marketing strategy, is trying to get out and encouraging people to try it. So, you know, doing demos ourselves, and, you know, going to stores. Herb has done
sending
the most
samples.
Amazing amount number of cold calls on restaurants. Just unbelievable. And I've done some, and not nearly as many. And I mean, I think, you know, if I look at marketing that we've done, I mean, it's been getting out and communicating to people how much we care about what we're doing and having them taste it, because then they, that's what sells them. I mean, that they connect with us somehow and they see that, and then they taste it and they like it.
I wish it were more brilliant than that.
How have they mostly taken, you know, I know you said you had early, you know, some early enthusiasm from some places like Zingerman's, but what about other retailers? Were they receptive to the idea or pretty unreceptive? Or?
It varied pretty much across the board. And I think the, you know, we gave the Italians a 2,000-year head start, you know, so we got a long ways to catch up. Yeah. You know, we have to, that's our biggest challenge when it comes to retail, is overcoming that preconception. And typically that happens if the retailer themselves get excited, if somebody gets excited. And typically that happens once they find that if they sample it. If they don't sample it, mm-hmm. it's going to die in their delicacy.
In other words, they put samples out for their customers.
Right.
I mean, it's got to get into the person's mouth. You know, it's like if they don't eat it, they don't know. Mm-hmm. And they're going to, and you know, we had a relationship with a chain, and they had an exclusive on our product to start out. And, you know, I walked into one of their stores. I mean, I knew real early in the relationship that it was destined to be difficult. I mean, the first thing, I walk into one of their stores that's only, they have, you know, literally hundreds of stores, and they're only offering it in four of them. I walk into one of those stores, and there are like six different kinds of prosciutto in that store, you know, and ours is over on the end. Oh, what's that stuff? Oh, I don't know, that stuff's made in the United States. You know, but they didn't know that they had an exclusive on it. They didn't know what it tasted like. They didn't know how it was made. They didn't know, you know, that the meat was special. They didn't know anything. You know, and that's, you know, we're not going to succeed in that kind of a context. We have to be, on the other hand, you know, like we've been in some places that are very well known for real high quality Italian foods, and the people got excited about it, and they brought it in, and they sampled it, and they, you know, all their customers, they said, which do you like better? And they put ours out next to the Italian, and the people would, you know, choose ours, and, you know, those people are going to do really well with it. And, you know, Zingerman's was kind of an interesting example because, you know, Ari Weinzweig, who's one of the partners, was very enthusiastic about what we were doing and was very receptive and liked what we made, you know. And then, but they have a real, distributed organization structure where, you know, people at their employees have authority, and they have tasting panels and selection panels and that kind of thing. And it took us about a year, really, to kind of get everybody having tried it and liking it.
Yeah.
You know, but one of my, you know, kind of more frustrating moments in the whole in this whole adventure was I went into a store to do a demo, and I walked up to the deli counter, and the guy was slicing our prosciutto. And so I said to him, "Hey, man, that's a nice looking prosciutto." And he goes, "Yeah, but it's not the good stuff." I go, "Oh, yeah, it's not the good stuff? What's the good stuff?" You know? And he said, "Oh, this stuff's that domestic. It's, you know, you got to have the Italian stuff." You know, I mean, here's a guy who's missing three teeth, and, you know, I don't know. Maybe he was a cordon bleu or, you know, a graduate of the CIA, but it didn't appear to be the case. So anyway, he was, you know, so I walk off to the side, you know, and just stand there, and I put myself in timeout. I said, you know, I don't want to embarrass myself, you know. So the store manager walks up to me and says, "Oh yeah, you heard of them? Great, great." I said, "Well, what are you doing?" I said, "Well, I'm in timeout." So I mean, that's a really deep-seated preconception, you know, and you know, we have to overcome that one person at a time.
Yeah.
Well, you were talking last night about the farmers, and I know we talked about that a little bit, but you know, just tell me a little more about how you scout out the farmers, how you work with them, maybe specifically about Jude Becker, and I think the other one you said was Russ Kramer.
Russ Kramer.
Okay. Yeah. Just how that's worked and developed over the years.
Well, all the people we buy from have to meet certain criteria in terms of animal welfare, feeding practices. Obviously, they have to have, everything has to be slaughtered at a USDA-approved plant. And we have visited at least some of the farmers for each of the groups that we buy from. So we haven't visited all of the farmers for all of the groups, but we've visited, you know, farmers for Nyman, farmers for Eden Farms, farmers for Heritage Ozark, and I don't know, we visited Organic Valley people too, and we visited Coleman people, we were buying Coleman meat, and also Beeler's. We picked out Nyman early because it was a natural relationship. Nyman Pork is headquartered.
And they had good
distribution
here in Des Moines, so they were, you know, and they're right here in Iowa, so that was pretty easy. But no, I think that the first thing was to wade through the kind of thicket of information and misinformation about what the real practices were of the different farming, what I call aggregators. You know, these companies that pulled together a group of farmers and have them grow, raise their meat to a certain set of standards, and then market them together under a brand so that they get enough kind of volume to get through the slaughterhouse and a group, and they get enough volume through the year so that, you know, this guy who has his pigs available in March, April, and May compliments a guy who has his pigs available in October, November, December, whatever, you know. And so the first thing was really to wade through all that information. That was really, Kathy did that.
I mean, everybody has animal welfare protocols.
Everybody who claims claims.
They make specific claims about it, and you can go online and you can look up what their standards are. And so, some of them are really excellent, and some of them are more window dressing than substance.
And you got to wade through them.
You
need, because there's a lot of verbiage, and a lot of it is some of it can be somewhat misleading. And you know, without, you know, one of the big questions that we had to resolve for ourselves was, where did the use of antibiotics fit in for us? I mean, we knew that we were firmly opposed to the idea of subtherapeutic antibiotics, but then the question was, well, what about therapeutic antibiotics? Like, if an animal's got an infection or if they're sick, is it humane not to give them a medicine that you have available? And so, you know, that was one of the questions that we had to, pretty much in terms of figuring out what we were willing to do, we had to deal with that.
And one of the places that we buy from, that we keep in a separate stream, they do use antibiotics for treating sick pigs. Then they hold them back for 100 days from the time that they administer the last antibiotic, which is more than three times as long as the USDA minimum. I think personally that it's more humane to treat than not to treat under those circumstances, because it's a terrible cost to the farmer if they have to pull that pig out of the premium pool and put it back in the commodity pool.
Yeah, we do that for our Berkshire meat. You know, and the reason that we think it's fair for the Berkshire meat is there's really, people who raise purebred Berkshire suffer a penalty for the low level of productivity of the animals. They grow slower, they're less animals in a litter, the mothers are not as good and are more likely to kill the live piglets, you know, and they've made all those they've kind of made that investment up front. You know, once a pig's born as a Berkshire, it can't be changed to a, you know, a York, you know, and oh, now it's gonna grow because I gave it antibiotics, you know, so. It seems fair that if that animal gets sick and it gets treated, and there's a sufficient delay after it's been treated before it's slaughtered, that that's a responsible practice. Mm-hmm. So that was a decision we had to make relatively early, and you know, also trying to figure out, because there are standards that are created by third parties that, you know, one would think are meaningful and reputable, but they, you know, you start digging into detail. Again, Kathy's the one who did that. You just didn't have anything, you know. So we had to come up with what we felt were responsible standards for ourselves, mm-hmm. you know, and that's where we got to the no confinement, no subtherapeutic antibiotics, no animal byproducts in the feed, and you know, the animals had to have enough space to move around so that they could have a place to bed in deep straw, a place to socially congregate, and then at least an apron or access to the outdoors. So we kind of came up with our own standards after kind of sorting through the maze and blizzard of information that was sent out by all the different potential suppliers. Oh yeah, I've got that.
Yeah. All my pigs are happy pigs. And I think the thing I mentioned last night is that there are a couple of places that when I've been there, I've said, if I had to be a market pig, this is where I'd want to be. Or a sow, for that matter.
Yeah.
It's a really great animal place.
Yes, yeah,
and
that
they have good animal lives. And I have absolutely no hesitation in thinking that these animals are treated well, they were able to express their pigginess appropriately, and then they had a very bad day at the end and were killed. And that's not so terrible. And the two, my two favorite places, the places I would choose to go if I had to be a pig, are Jude Becker's and Russ in northeastern Iowa and Russ Kramer's in southeastern Missouri.
You know, we're working really a little bit on that kind of bad day part of it. And this kind of speaks to that question you brought about eating local. Or, you know, right now all the meat that we buy is comes from slaughterhouses within a 200-mile radius. Okay, which is good. It's great, and you know, it's great for the carbon footprint kind of thing. But you know, some of the pigs that go up to northwestern Iowa come from central Missouri. That's a long way.
It's too far.
You know, it's a long way, and so that group that that was our Mountain Pork group is setting up a place to kill their pigs within about 60 miles from, you know, 60 mile, and all their growers will be in a, maybe like a 60 mile radius. And that's great, you know, and I think even though it means that we'll be pulling our meat from further away, I think the animal welfare aspect is very positive. You know, and so we've been encouraging them to, you know, move towards that as quickly as they can. And, you know, it's, I don't know where it fits into the whole local thing, but, I mean, it's probably, it's contrary to the whole local thing, but I think it's positive in terms of the quality of the meat that we're going to get and the kind of rationality of it from, you know, in terms of, like, how food comes together.
Yeah.
You know, because it makes a lot more sense to transport meat than it does to transport animals. You know, just like I think it makes a lot more sense to transport meat than it does to transport grain to feed animals. You know?
Mm-hmm.
So.
Right, because that's, I was reading something that was talking about, you know, California, they end up bringing so much of the grain in from the Midwest.
Right.
And or somebody who's buying raw meat in the Midwest and making things with it in California, that's a long haul for a highly perishable.
It's a tough, I think it's tough. It's a long feedback loop too.
Mm-hmm. It's a
really
long
tough
feedback loop.
You know, so I mean, all those issues that we talked about, because, you know, for somebody like Paul in California, he's, you know, the meat showed up in California, you know, 4 days later, and he's got to accept it or reject it. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's tough. I mean, I know he's had challenges too. It's we have the same thing. It's a few days, but at least, you know, if we really are unhappy, we go there.
I mean, Herb,
you know,
Herb has been up
time
to Supreme in northwest Iowa a lot. He's been up to Ankeny a lot, and I would guess that we will be
and Pine Ridge,
making and Pine Ridge a lot, and we will be making trips to central Missouri quite a bit, because
just to get things
you know, started,
get on the same
to show
wavelength,
and to show people how serious and necessary our stipulations are. I mean, it's not just random that there's a real, and we've had people, one thing that's been great is that some of the places where we've had our meat trimmed or slaughtered, they've actually come here to see what we do with it with some of their lead people, and then that way we can explain why it matters
and show them, like when I showed you that cut and how that had opened up, you know, it's really helpful to be able to show them something like that and say, hey, that's why I care. You know, it's not that I'm just being a jerk, you know.
Yeah.
I may be a jerk anyway,
but you know. Yeah, really. You can plenty of other criteria to judge that.
Yeah.